All right, you're listening to the CBSSports.com NBA Facts and Rumors podcast. My name is Matt Moore, and with me today are Kevin Pelton and Bradford Doolittle of Basketball Prospectus. Their new book, The Basketball Prospectus for 2010-2011, is out currently. You can reach it at basketballprospectus.com. Want to talk to these guys a little bit about the book and about kind of the direction of metrics as they go forward in the NBA. Now, guys, I want to ask you first off, what do you think is the real goal of this book? Like, what is it that you want to provide to the basketball community?
Well, I'll start with, to me, what we want to do is to just provide a conduit between what the teams and the players are doing and which way they're headed, and the fans who just like to sit in front of their league pass and watch the games. And I think that the book is a great way to prepare for the season in terms of whether you're playing for fantasy sports or you just want to get up to snuff on who's playing where and how the teams have come together over the summer and what the major issues in the league are. But then as you're watching the season, you see a guy that you're not totally familiar with, you can pick up this guide, look him up, and find out what his strengths and weaknesses are and where he's at in his career and, you know, if he's a legit prospect. And so to me, the thing that we want to do more than anything is, even though we use a lot of analytics, is to really just be a general scouting guide and to help people enjoy the season more from that standpoint.
Yeah, you know, I've read pretty much constantly last year, like even like throughout the season, even in March and April, I would pick up my copy and just reference things and kind of see, you know, what he was projected as and kind of the description where he had last year and then where I saw the players developing as the year went along. It's interesting too, because I like the fact that the book is so approachable for the common fan in terms of it's not just the metrics. It's also, there's a lot of analysis in there and some insight too from the people that you guys have talked to in the league.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes people, you know, hear about this tool element and the projections that are in there, and they sort of get the impression that you're buying page after page of numbers, but that's very much not what we've tried to do. And I think Bradford would echo that both of us kind of grew up, you know, and have been reading these kind of books for years. One of my prized possessions was my Rick Barry Pro Basketball Bible in 1995-96, which I think might have been the last year that he and Jordan Cohn did it, and just a great resource for finding out about every player and, you know, their strengths and weaknesses, tendencies, things like that, that, you know, at that time, before League Pass, it was really a revelation, and now I think it's just more of a handy guide to complement what people are already able to see.
And Kevin, one of the things I think is really great about it in terms of, you know, I'm a big proponent of advanced stats and empirics, and I'm obviously not a big member on the APBR metrics board, but I used to dabble around there and kept up on it. One of the things I like the best about the numbers that you guys use is, you know, there's this debate between, you know, the standard box score, which everyone's really moving away from, and then some of the more standard advanced metrics like offensive rating and things like that. And then there's kind of Dave Barry's diversion into that whole area. And then I really like the fact that a lot of the metrics that you guys use in the book and with Moscone and Warp and all those kind of things, they're very applicable things that make sense. Is that kind of part of the approach that you guys took to the project?
I think definitely any time that you can try to make things understandable to fans, and, you know, we don't want to be above their heads, and, you know, we do get a little into the acronyms and that sort of thing, like our baseball perspective counterparts, but, you know, I think like using wins and wins above replacement players is something that everyone understands, the concept of, you know, this team's three wins better than this team, so, you know, this player is contributing X number of wins. I mean, it's a nice tangible thing to use in comparing players, so I think that's a positive of our system.
You guys lean heavily on the blogosphere also. That's one of the things I, of course, being a blog guy, liked a lot, is the fact that so many of the writers in your previews, in terms of the overall previews for the teams, as it were, involve bloggers. You know, what is it you guys feel like you get out of that versus going to some, you know, just team personnel, which I know you guys have also spoken with and stuff like that? What is it you think that the bloggers kind of bring to those previews?
Well, for me, because we do cover the whole league, and it's really hard to keep up with everything that's going on with 30 teams and all the players on that team. And reading the blogs on a day-to-day basis really gives me a feeling for what the concerns of each of those fan bases are. And the best bloggers, and of course you're in those ranks, Matt, is they really are not just sympathetic to the quantitative approach to the game, but many of them are very skilled in using that in their own analysis. And because they're interpreting their teams from that platform, then it helps me understand what's going on with those teams by reading those blogs. And, you know, there's just so much good work out there. When it just comes to knowing what the news is with the team, you know, you can just take a couple of minutes to browse the daily headlines that are coming out of the newspapers. But to really understand below the surface what's going on with the teams, the blogs, I think, are just an invaluable resource.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things that I've noticed has really been evolving is numbers that are based around there's, you know, the estimations that have been used and the calculations that have been used, and those have been around for years in the APBR metrics board. And also, for me, like, a huge impact has been Synergy. So when I got access to Synergy, it's pretty much like revolutionized the way I look at the game. I love being able to go and actually be able to pinpoint and say, you know, okay, player is allowing X points per possession on this kind of level. What do you think the balance should be to be struck between kind of this big picture stuff that a lot of the great measures that you guys use and these really individualized possession set play type stuff that's involved in Synergy? Like, where is the kind of crossover in that?
I think you've got to kind of draw the distinction between, you know, measuring skills, which is something that those Synergy numbers do really well, and at the offensive end more, I think some of our numbers do really well, and then measuring value. And there's two kind of different things, because, you know, how valuable a player is ultimately crucial, and you can't let that go just because the fact that someone is really great in one area can't make up for, you know, deficiencies in other aspects of the game. But at the same time, if all you're looking at is just, hey, is this player good or not? Well, you're not getting a sense for why. And that's often as important in the equation as how, especially in a game like basketball, where it's not just about picking the five best players and putting them out there. It's about fitting together strengths and weaknesses and things like that. So obviously the best way to kind of get that question of how or why answered is often by watching the games. But then I think we supplement it quite a bit with those more individualized metrics and Synergy and things like that, which, you know, Synergy is a case where it's probably the most perfect marriage possible of you've got the numbers overall owed there to rate a player's overall performance, but then you can also go in and look at the clips and see why something is happening.
I want to ask you, how difficult is it to kind of get an established system for the rookies? Are you guys comfortable with kind of the translation from their college numbers in terms of the projection? I'm sure there's an article out there to kind of describe the accuracy on those kinds of attempts. But I imagine it's got to be hard to kind of predict how these guys are going to come in, because, I mean, we all struggle with trying to predict how good these guys are going to be. I had very strong feelings that Darren Collison was going to be pretty good last year, but I had no idea he was going to possess the kind of perimeter speed that he has. Is that a struggle when you guys are putting the book together to kind of figure out, especially rookies that have a huge impact, like John Wall?
I would say that, you know, historically we've found some trends and things like that. So there are certain statistics that tend to carry over better. Rebounding, for example, is something that you can be pretty confident if a guy is an elite rebounder at the NCAA level that he's going to be a very good pro rebounder as well. So DeJuan Blair was an example of that last year, but also someone like John Brockman, who was even maybe more one-dimensional in terms of that was his strength, and it translated perfectly when he made that transition, despite the fact that people worried about his size. You know, Wall is an interesting example because of the fact that one of the groups that we find tends to be underrepresented by their college statistics is these super quick point guards who come into the NBA and take advantage of the hand-checking rules and the fact that so little contact is allowed in the perimeter. It really emphasizes speed, and they come into the league and thrive in a way that point guards didn't even 6 years ago still. So, you know, that's a challenge right there of kind of – but I think that if you understand those trends, you can augment the statistics with that knowledge that – someone's going to be better than they look or not quite as good as they look.
Kind of switching gears, I want to talk to you a little bit about there's been a series of articles that have kind of outlined on Houston Rockets blogs that were talking about the different approaches that Daryl Morey's taken and whether or not, you know, the Rockets' efforts are going to be successful and how big of a year this is for them, because they're kind of stuck in the middle between building towards the future and trying to put something together now for Yao Ming. I kind of noticed some parallels in between that and the discussion that Mark Cuban recently had on his blog, where basically he was like, you know, we're still going to use quantitative measures, but using it for team building is really not the way to go because of the chemistry factor. I kind of want to get you guys' thoughts on that and how you feel about, you know, quantitative measures and as far as team building, not just for evaluation or play sets or those kinds of things, but in terms of team building.
Well, you know, the Cube tends to be a little bombastic, and
no.
You know, I like the guy. I think he's a fantastic personality for the NBA, and I always go back and forth whether I would want him to be the owner of my favorite team, and I think I would. I mean, he's a committed guy. You know, I'd probably get tired of him, but, you know, I think my franchise would be competitive with him as an owner. I'm not sure why he felt the need to come out and say that, but I when you look at the number of teams that use quantitative analysis at this point, it's pretty clear that it's part of the puzzle. It's, you can't build a team strictly off statistics or any kind of statistical analysis, and you'll never find Kevin and I writing anything claiming that you can. But what one of the things that quantitative analysis allows you to do is to take, you know, you have your traditional scouts and you have their evaluation of what you have, but statistics, if they're used in the right way, can really help you gauge on what you have against what is in the league. I mean, you can say, you know, Derrick Rose is one of the fastest players in the league, but how is that quickness turning into production, and how does that production compare to other guys at his position? And, you know, how rare are the things that he brings to the court, you know, compared to what everybody else has? And, you know, I despite what Cuban said, I don't see the trend towards employing quantitative analysis and team building going the other direction. I just think it's going to become more and more ingrained in NBA front offices as younger execs come up and move into positions of responsibility.
Well, I certainly hope so in that regard. And I'd make a couple of points. I think one thing worth remembering on Cuban is he kind of comes at it from a different perspective than a lot of the other people like Maury who are using statistics in front offices, and that his interest is much more in plus minus, I would say, than some of those individual metrics like what you'll find in our book. So those tend to be, you know, do a much worse job of explaining fit and things like that, I would say, in many regards. You know, they're just telling you how a player helped his team in a very specific role with a specific set of teammates. So I think that, you know, if you understand that, then why he thinks that they're maybe not as useful as team building is understandable. And then also Cuban has used them more on the coaching side in terms of looking at lineups that work for his team once those players are put together than in terms of actually selecting those players. But from Maury's perspective and what the Rockets are doing, I think he's been very clear that, you know, statistics can often help you find these undervalued guys, but very rarely are those players going to be superstars. You know, Kevin Martin possibly could be an exception to that rule if he really gets back to full health and hits and fits well in Houston. But that's what the Rockets are still finding themselves in that position of, especially if Yao Ming can't be that player because of his health. How do you find another superstar player? And statistics, you know, Daryl Morey has been clear, don't really help them there. It's just a matter of finding the right trade or something like that.
You know, one of the things that I like best about the book, I list off like 9 things about him. So listeners, if you're wondering, I cannot endorse you enough to go purchase this thing. It's brilliant. BasketballPerspectives.com. You really should go pick it up. One of the things I like are the player comparisons. I find those to always be really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the process of how you decided to, one, go with this, and two, how you determine those players that are comparables, the most similar to?
Well, that's the heart of the Shaney projection system. So that's something that worked out first several years ago and then kind of refined over the years to get it down to 13 core player statistics and then also height and weight that, you know, you measure the difference between two players in each of those categories and then square it to emphasize the fact that big differences, you know, if you've got someone who blocks a ton of shots, they're probably very different from someone who almost blocks no shots or something like that. So the plus that we borrowed from our friends at Baseball Prospectus and Nate Silver, who now has gone on to bigger and better things and helping run the country with 538.com, and he introduced this kind of theory of how to calculate similarity scores, and we've just kind of adapted that for basketball and tried to do the same thing with our database, which goes back to 1979-80 and pulled the most similar players from there.
Great. So I want to talk to you. You've got a section in the back on the D-League, which I've obviously been a huge proponent of the league, and I've done a lot of work with them and things like that, and I'm excited to see that there's you know, coverage of it. One, do you think we could possibly see some D-League stats thrown into Prospectus this year? Possibly?
You know, tracking those all down is a little more difficult than it is in the NBA. But you get so many players in and out constantly. But we do have the translations this year of players who have played a significant amount of minutes in the D-League and don't have that kind of experience in the NBA. So Alexei Ajinsa comes to the top of mind. Will Conway, one of my all-time favorites, the Crash Davis of the D-League, is what we call him in the book. Those guys, the projections that we have for what they would do if they were in the NBA and getting minutes this season are based strictly on the history of how D-League statistics have translated to the NBA.
Exciting stuff. You know, usage, I think, is one of the things I think is one of the elements that I wish the casual fans understood better. I feel like usage is one of those elements. I've done a lot of work on paroxysm in terms of laying out kind of how usage is adapted on a team level and throughout the league. Do you feel like that there's a way to you know, make that clear to people how important usage can be, just in terms of, you know, this is the number of possessions that a player is taking up? Is that something that you feel like is still undervalued? Am I right in that assessment, or do you feel like usage is kind of getting to the point where people understand it? I mean, obviously not your casual fan, but most people in the basketball community understand the value of usage and how to evaluate it.
If they don't understand it, you know, by that term usage, I think they understand it as a concept, but there are, you know, you bring up what is kind of at the core of player evaluation, at least from an offensive standpoint, and that is the relationship between usage and efficiency. And that is something that really all we can do is just keep hammering on it and bringing it up as we describe players and what's working and what's not. But that is something that we would like to become a mainstream idea, that people understand that, you know, if you know that Tyreke Evans is averaging 24 points, but he's got a usage rate of 38 and the Kings are getting pounded every night. They know that he's searching for that barrier where he's using an appropriate number of possessions in an efficient manner, and the units that he plays on are also producing points in an efficient manner. And it is just a very fundamental aspect of basketball analysis. You know, I don't know if there's like an equivalent in basketball to OPS, which entered pretty much the mainstream. I mean, you can use it in newspapers for the most part now, and people sort of know what it is. I don't know if usage is what we would push, but it would be high up on the list, at least in my opinion.
I want to talk to you guys a little bit about the Raptors, because I feel like the Raptors are going to be a fascinating example of, like, you know, are right now actually a fascinating example of how people view the league, because I think that I've done a lot of looking into the Raptors. I'm for whatever reason, I've gotten an attachment for Andrea Bargnani. I think it's mostly out of pity. I think I just feel bad the fact that there's so much that Raptors fans are pinning so much of the problems on Bargnani. I was looking at that team in Summer League and thinking about the guys that they had on the floor in Summer League. I looked at some of their numbers on Synergy and some of their numbers in advanced things like in Prospectus, and I took kind of an overall view. And I was like, you know, with what I've seen of Bosch's advanced stats, I really think that this team might be able to pull out 35 wins. I'd actually said that, and then I flip open Prospectus, and sure enough, you know, Sheeny's predicting 35 wins. And you guys say that you're a little uncomfortable with that one, that sometimes the numbers produce things that you think are going to be or don't seem to follow in line with convention. So I think that the Raptors are going to be one of those that is going to be an interesting case of where the kind of analysis lies, whether it's, you know, sometimes you just have to take, you know, the common view, which is if you look at the Raptors, you're like, okay, they didn't have anybody all that good. They traded Turkoglu for Barbosa, but that doesn't help much. And they lost an all-star in Chris Bosh. So obviously they've got to be terrible. What are you guys' thoughts on the Raptors in terms of both from an analytics standpoint that you've noticed and just from your, you know, knowledge of the game?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually just finished writing something on the Raptors. I'm going to put up in a little bit on the site. Yeah, they were here in Chicago on Tuesday, and I had dinner with the two Raptors beat writers that were in town, and I told them what our projection was, and they kind of looked at each other, and so I defended it, saying, you know, well, this could work out, and this could work out. And they said, yeah, you know, but that's not outrageous, but that's the highest projection we've heard. And then I saw them play, and they were just brutal on Tuesday night, and I think that was by far their worst preseason game. And Linus Klaser didn't play, who I think is going to emerge as their top scorer this year and number one offensive option. But they were terrible on defense. They got out-rebounded 44-22. And, you know, we don't like the, quote, rebound margin too often. But, you know, 44-22 tells a pretty conclusive story. And Bargnani was 3-for-9, and that was his best shooting performance of the preseason. He's 5-for-26 from the floor now so far in the preseason. And he just looks lost out there. And after watching that game, I wasn't feeling too good about the 35-win projection. But, you know, they got a lot of new parts. They got guys moving into new roles. And you never know how these things are going to come together. But the thing is, they are clearly a team that's developing. They are trying to move Bargnani into a new role. He's the guy they would like to emerge as the number one offensive option, which means they're going to be asking him to do things that he hasn't had to do as much of in the past. And at times when teams are developing certain players to do certain things and trying to break in new players, at some point they're going to be trying to break in rookie Ed Davis into their rotation when he gets healthy. And you sacrifice wins for that player development. So mathematically, the 35-win projection may make perfect sense when you look at the patterns of the veterans on the roster and what they could do if they're used in that way. But because the Raptors may end up emphasizing different things and trying to move guys into roles that they haven't played in the past, you know, you can't really account for that in a statistical model. So they may actually be a 35-win team in terms of quality, but they may not get there because that's not what they're trying to do. And, you know, really what value is there in being a 35-win team? You know, they're probably better off getting a high lottery pick next year.
You know, I think it's interesting that the two of the teams that most people gravitate and think that we've got overrated in the East are Cleveland and Toronto, both of those teams that lost their big pieces. So I don't know if it's a matter of the statistics saying that one guy is not quite as important as we make them out to be, or there was more talent there, but, you know, alongside them before than we gave credit necessarily. But yeah, I mean, Toronto is an interesting case. I think one thing that shows up statistically is, you know, we have them projected, I believe, to be the worst defense in the league, but not a historically bad defense like they were a year ago, which is hard to repeat 2 years in a row. Although the duo of Bargnani and Triano may pull it off. You never know.
When you guys found, basically I'm doing this for SEO purposes, and because if I mention the Heat, my hits automatically skyrocket. So when you guys were doing your analysis of the Heat, did anything surprise you about what you found in the projections for that team?
Well, you know, there's a chart on the Heat's roster comparing their roster to the Bulls roster in the Bulls chapter of the book. And I was actually surprised when looking at the Heat outside of the big three, how in the aggregate they projected about as bad as you would think they would have projected before they signed all those guys. Because, you know, after they signed those, everybody was like, well, they're not going to have they're not going to be able to bring in any quality reserves. And then they signed a lot of guys with names. You know, they signed Mike Miller, who I think is going to be a good and viable member of that team. But then, you know, a lot, you know, they bring back Jamal McGlure and they bring in Ilgauskas and Eddie House and a lot of guys like that. And as a group, you know, when you talk about strictly what the definition of replacement level is, which is being able to go out and find a freely available player from the D League and plug him into a roster, that's what you have beyond James Bosch and Wade. And people, I think mainstream analysts were actually pretty high on that supporting cast. Statistically, it's not looking too good. And so it'll be very interesting to see how that shakes out.
I would say that Bradford and I disagree a little bit on the Heat. I'm probably much more optimistic about their chances of winning the title this year. You know, the 60-win projection that Chaney has them on, people are like, whoa, that's so low. They're not challenging for 72-10 or, you know, something like that. But, you know, I don't think that they're ready to be a historically great team because of those limitations, but I think that the strength of support, the star trio, is such that as long as they stay healthy, they'll cover for those weaknesses. I do think they're clearly the favorite in the league.
I thought it was interesting that LeBron James's rebounding percentage is projected to drop to the lowest it's been in quite a while. It drops pretty significantly. Is that mostly based off of what you think his role is going to be, or how does Chaney kind of figure that into the equation?
There's a pretty significant adjustment for diminishing returns at the defensive rebounding level in particular. So a case where, you know, everybody talks about the offensive talents they've added and how well those all mix, and that's something that Chaney tries to estimate with their usage rates and that relationship with efficiency, but also someplace where they're, you know, they added a great rebounding small forward and a very good rebounding power forward. You know, to Dwayne Wade is already one of the best rebounding guards in the league, so even without having a traditional great center on the glass, I mean, Joel Anthony's really very poor at rebounding for a center, but still, as a group, they figure to be one of the best rebounding teams in the league to actually take away a few rebounds from each other.
So last question, what's the most annoying thing you hear from stats opponents in regards to your work, which is, you know, well-regarded and pretty high? I'm sure you guys don't deal with the level of ignorance that I do on a daily basis in terms of my personal one is you can't put numbers on heart. That's the one that grinds my gears the most. What's the one that bugs you guys the most?
Jay Triano gave me that exact line on Tuesday.
Don't get me started on Triano. Don't get me started.
I would say that it's probably just people who think that everything that Chaney says in those projections is exactly what we think, which it's not. I mean, we've got to be intellectually honest and put out what the numbers say. On average, right now, we think that's the best way that statistically we can project teams. But do I think that the Warriors are better than the Lakers, for example? No, I'm not insane, okay?
Awesome. So we've been talking
I'll throw one out there. During this summer, Frank Isola, the New York Beat writer, went on Twitter and said, "I don't read Basketball Prospectus. I write about people." And I don't think he was necessarily pointing at us. He was just talking about statistical analysis in general. But, you know, I actually got on there and with a profane response because it really irritated me, and then he deleted the tweet. But I hate the perception that all we care about is numbers and not the game of basketball or the stories within basketball, because I know Kevin and I have been huge NBA fans our entire lives, and we love everything about the game, and statistics is just a tool that we use, but we love the stories of the games, and we love the game itself, and we both play basketball, and we love everything there is about basketball, and I hate that perception that we're just, you know, sitting here with spreadsheets and that's all that we have.
I think if you read the book, you guys, it's almost impossible to come to that conclusion. Kevin Pelton, Bradford Doolittle of BasketballPerspectus.com, their new book, The Basketball Prospectus for 2010-2011, is out now. It's available on their site at BasketballPerspectus.com. It's also on Amazon. Be sure to check it out. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate you having us and all the kind words about the book.
Thanks. We'll check it out next time on CBSSports.com's NBA Facts and Rumors podcast. This is Matt Moore.